Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. I'd like now to welcome to the program Winona Howder. She is Executive Director of Food and Water Watch, and that group is sponsoring a screening of the film Gasland tonight at 7 o'clock at the Center for Contemporary Arts here in Santa Fe. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
I'm so glad to be here and glad to be in New Mexico.
So I watched a screener of this movie, Gasland, last night, and it is an extraordinary film. It's a beautifully made and very personal film by director Josh Fox, who I'm sorry, I hope we get to talk to him sometime in the future, but it's a very, very good film about hydraulic fracturing, the gas extracting industry, and the problems that have arisen all around the United States. Many, many states he visited, and many more states, are doing natural gas extraction. Let's start with a very basic and important question, which is, what is hydraulic fracturing or fracking?
Okay, well, what people need to understand about fracking is that it's much different than the kind of drilling that used to be done for natural gas, which had its own set of problems. Fracking injects a mixture of millions of gallons of water, sand, and a cocktail of toxic chemicals, and it injects it under high pressure into very, very dense rock formations, shale, tight sandstone, or coal beds. And we always explain that it's kind of like having a pipe bomb explode underground that cracks the rock and releases this methane, which is what natural gas is. And it's a fairly new technology that uses all of these chemicals. In fact, the U.S. Congress in their investigation found that fracking fluids contained 750 chemicals, and we're talking about some things that are really hazardous to human health, like benzene and lead, toluene, and even diesel fuel that has a lot of carcinogens. And the chemicals used don't need to be disclosed, and that's because Hal Burton, developed this technology, worked closely with Dick Cheney, who got an exemption for fracking from the Safe Drinking Water Act.
So the chemicals, although we know to some extent what they are what they call proprietary, which means it's hard to actually monitor for them because we don't know what they are in the first place to monitor for.
That's exactly right. And, you know, with fracking, there are so many problems, it's sometimes hard to know where to begin in talking about all of the negative things that can happen. But one thing we know, that here in the dry West, this takes literally millions of gallons of water. And that's one of the things that's a little bit different about this than the regular drilling, which also takes water. But to get this very high pressure, they have to inject this water, and it goes horizontally rather than the traditional vertical wells. And the New York Times did a tremendous investigative report with a series of five, and they found things that that the radioactivity in the drilling wastewater is like hundreds of thousands of times more than the EPA drinking water standard. And so what's happening when this water is being released, besides putting all of these deadly chemicals deep down into the ground where it gets into drinking water and aquifers, there's also radioactivity being released. And something has to happen to this water. It usually 30 to 70% of it comes back out of the well. And in the West, it's injected often back into the ground. In the East, it's often sent to wastewater facilities that aren't capable of getting rid of the toxics like radioactivity.
Why is there radioactivity in the water? What's up with that?
Well, you know, all drilling creates the problem of releasing radioactivity because locked deep into these rock layers is a lot of radiation. And so when you're injecting the water into the rock and all of the chemicals and breaking them open, the radioactivity from these rock formations ends up getting into the fracking wastewater. So it's natural occurring radiation, but it's deep in the ground where it belongs.
So there are many problems that you have been talking about, and the film Gasland actually goes and visits the homes of people who are in gas country, who are doing things like lighting their faucets, their water, on fire.
Yes, that's absolutely true. And you know what's really disgusting is that people like T. Boone Pickens, the billionaire oil tycoon, you know, he's trotting around the country, getting on all of the major TV shows, doing all sorts of media, saying that there's never been a problem, and he's been fracking for 40 years. What he really means is that he's been drilling, and in a lot of those places, nobody is looking for the problems. But the methane is being released because that's what natural gas is methane. And so when it's when this pipe bomb is basically being set off underground and the natural gas is being collected, not all of the natural gas is going where it should be. And there has been a very important study recently, and that's a study published by the National Academy of Sciences in collaboration with Duke University. It came out in April of this year, and it found that average methane concentrations in the drinking water in these active drilling areas is 17 times higher than those in non-active areas. And the methane concentrations of drinking water is closest to the gas wells, and it often causes these potential explosions. For instance, I know in the Four Corners, Colorado, a house exploded because of this methane collection.
When you say that fracking is a relatively new technology, how new is it? In other words, how many years have we been fracking, and how much data have we collected about it?
Well, fracking, this type of fracking and drilling has been in existence in the last 10 years, and really it's over the last 5 years that we've seen this become a strategy that's used in several places of the country, especially Texas and the Barnett Shale area. There's been a huge amount of fracking done there in the last 5 years. And one of the things that we're seeing, it's not just water pollution, but places like the Dallas-Fort Worth area, there's actually fracking taking place in the outskirts of Fort Worth. And the airborne pollutants from these fracking sites really threatens the people that are living nearby. What has happened in Dallas-Fort Worth is that the smog, and you know, smog is the reaction of chemicals with sunlight, and so the airborne pollutants from the fracking industry has caused more smog than from all of the motor vehicles in that entire area. And the residents of Dish, Texas, which is located near 11 natural gas compression stations, has so much odor, noise, and health problems that the mayor of the town has moved away and is now speaking out about fracking. And what's happening there is they had to actually hire a private environmental consultant who, in 2009, found that the air samples there contained high levels of neurotoxins and carcinogens, and they're actually, it's killing animals, and it's giving the residents of this area headaches, and they're blacking out. And I think that's what the great thing about Gaslands is. Gaslands takes these terrible things that are happening around the country, and it personalizes them so that people can really see what the impact is on the communities. And I think what people need to realize here in New Mexico is that if this fracking technology is allowed to move forward, any place that these shale formations exist, there's going to be fracking in the future. And we're seeing the really big guys get back in this. So up in the northwest corner of the state where there's been some fracking, that's BP that's building up, or rather that's buying up the land leases. And right now, the 10 of the 10 largest natural gas producers going into fracking, ExxonMobil is number one, and BP is number four, and all of the other big oil companies, ConocoPhillips, Chevron, Shell, they're all getting into this. And part of the problem is that, over the past 15 years, natural gas has been promoted as a way to solve a lot of our energy problems as a transition fuel, because when it's used, it produces less CO2. But there has been a landmark study. In fact, there have been 10 studies over the last 18 months on the subject of fracking. We're collecting a lot more information. But this was a study that was published by Cornell University, and they found that shale fracking could have a greater effect on climate change than coal and oil over the life cycle of its production. And, while natural gas combustion releases less CO2, drilling in this really tight shale and the sand formations, when you look at the full life cycle of the production of climate change gases, there's much more methane coming out, and methane traps 21 times more heat by weight than carbon dioxide.
Right.
And so this isn't going to be a transition fuel if it's creating more problems with our climate than the traditional fossil fuels. And it also, there's a lot of effort by the industry into getting federal investments into building an infrastructure that's going to be with us, 40 to 60 years. There's a new law that's being heavily promoted, and by a lot of the legislators that we typically think of as being better. It's the Nat Gas Act is what it's called, and it's basically about giving incentives to switch vehicles to natural gas. And actually, the bigger the vehicle, the more of a financial incentive to the buyer. So you can see this isn't about being efficient. It's about using more of the natural gas. And when you see the plans of the gas industry, a lot of this is about exporting gas. And we have become the largest producer of gas in the world now, largest producer and user.
At a great cost, apparently.
Right, and it's we've surpassed Russia. And here's what is really frightening. Countries like China are buying stakes in these areas. So China has bought a third of a stake in the second largest gas producer in the U.S., which is Chesapeake Energy. They're the main company going into the Northeast, into New York, where this is such a big issue. And India is getting into this, and they're also beginning to produce do this fracking in their own country. And you can see the impacts on our climate as China begins to drill for its enormous resources in natural gas. They have a tremendous amount of these shale formations.
We're talking to Winona Howder, the executive director of Food and Water Watch. I think it's really worth emphasizing that while natural gas may burn a little cleaner than other kinds of fossil fuels, the extraction of it totally negates that. I mean, not only, for example, as you say, in Dallas-Fort Worth, the extraction of natural gas through fracking produces more smog than every vehicle in Dallas-Fort Worth combined, which is, that's a lot of vehicles.
Yeah.
But there's also, in this film Gasland, which is screening tonight at 7 o'clock at the CCA, there's also this issue of evaporation sprayers. So some of this toxic stuff comes back out of the ground, and instead of putting it in, I mean, it's bad enough to put it in unlined pits, but they're spraying it into the air.
Yeah, absolutely. They're doing that, and they're, in some cases, putting it into municipal wastewater facilities, and then that wastewater gets dumped right back in the drinking water of you know, lots of people. So there's no place to deal with this toxic fluid. So number one, you're using more water than you know should be used for something this toxic, and especially here in the West. I mean, in New Mexico, can you imagine using millions more gallons of water when, I mean, there's a drought going on now, and we know with climate change, there are going to be more droughts in this area of the country in the future. And then spraying this toxic, these toxic chemicals and all of the residue on the lands, I mean, this is just not the way that we want to produce energy. And we should be spending our federal dollars on promoting the renewable technologies and energy efficiency technologies, not these fossil fuel technologies that we need to move off of. And, you know, I'd urge your listeners to go to our website. We published a report last week called The Case for a Ban on Gas Fracking, and it lays out all of the evidence from these 10 studies and investigations and makes a case for why we need to start creating the political space to do more than even talk about disclosing the chemicals or regulating the chemicals. We need to start talking about banning a technology that wastes and pollutes our drinking water and the water that's necessary to produce food. We need to start fighting for what we want, not what we think might be negotiated around the edges.
Right, right. The website, by the way, is foodandwaterwatch.org. Now, the film Gasland shows a lot of people who have been negatively affected. There are ranchers whose cattle are sick, whose children are sick, they themselves are sick, all kinds of people are suffering. And one of the things that I think is so painful and extremely unjust about this whole situation is that the agencies of the individual states charged with protecting the environment are often really in league with the gas companies, and individuals are not represented by their government and have virtually no recourse.
That's exactly right. I mean, what we need to do is to really build a constituency, organize around this, and hold these public officials accountable for the health, the disease, and the hardships that these people are experiencing. And, you know, this is going to impact lots and lots of people who don't even live right at the fracking sites because it's going to affect drinking water. I mean, a good example that's been well documented in the East is the drinking water of 15 million people, including New York City and Philadelphia, will be impacted by the drilling in the Delaware River Basin. That's where Josh Fox's farm is in Pennsylvania. He talks about this very eloquently in the film. And this is there's a federal commission with appointed members that make the decision about some of this drilling that's going on, not just the states. And President Obama could do something about this by the Army Corps of Engineers has a vote. But we find that the administration is being very silent on this issue because of their relationship to the natural gas industry and, you know, the funding that's been provided for President Obama's election and, you know, and many lawmakers. And we have to hold these people accountable.
It's, once again, it seems to me that almost every issue where there's an environmental problem goes back to the problem of campaigns being financed by the wealthy in this nation, whether those people be individuals or corporations.
I think that's exactly right, and I think people here should know that Governor Martinez, who since she has come into office has been doing favors for all of her corporate and wealthy campaign contributors, she received $1 million from the industry that wants to frack New Mexico.
And
that was 14% of her campaign contributions.
Right. Yeah, and so people don't, I mean, in Gasland themselves, I mean, in areas where gas drilling is about to occur, a lot of people seem not to know what they're in for.
I think that's right. I mean, I think we have to do a lot of education because, you know, you don't see, well, the New York Times has done a terrific job, and we've seen some news coverage of this in some areas of the state where fracking is going on. But, you know, I think generally we need to collectively get this information out there widely because there's a big plan to frack many, many states in the U.S. And if when you go to our website, foodandwaterwatch.org, and look at this report, you will see the front cover or the inside cover, there's a map of the U.S. and all of the shale deposits. And they're very widespread because this new technology allows drilling in places that have never been drilled before in these very hard rock formations. And so this is a massive danger to our drinking water and our health in a number of areas in the country.
One of the things that I think is really important to talk about is that because of citizen movements in the past, we actually have pretty good health and safety standards in certain areas. So our furnaces are pretty safe. And, you know, I have a gas and carbon monoxide detector in my house so that if there is a leak, I will be warned. And our cars are pretty safe, and we have airbags and all this stuff. But the fuels that they burn are extracted in a way where there's no safety regulations of any kind whatsoever, and in fact a huge lobbying effort to see that there are not and will never be any safety regulations.
Right. I mean, we believe when you really look at the evidence around fracking that it's a huge danger to our natural resources, and we don't believe that it can be or would be done safely. I mean, there's been some talk of tightening the regulations around the way that the drilling apparatus is built. For instance, the casings tend to leak, and these wells are drilled for many years, and the older the casing, the more accidents that there will be. But, you know, what we've seen with these big oil companies, I mean, I think we have a very dramatic and terrible example with BP. Why would we ever think that even if you could have technology, which I don't believe you could have, but even if you could, that they would go to the expense of using that technology? There was a big accident that happened in Pennsylvania in March. It was a blowout, polluted. A lot of wastewater was dumped into the ecology in northeastern Pennsylvania, and it was a blowout preventer that caused the accident. But now, does that sound familiar? Remember BP's accident in the Gulf was a blowout preventer.
Right.
So, you know, these technologies that are supposed to be working so well and protecting us often don't. And I think that as a public interest community, and, you know, it's especially difficult for a lot of the environmental groups to really go out against natural gas because they've been promoting natural gas. But I think we need to re-examine this, and we actually need to start calling natural gas what it is. It's methane, and it's a serious reason for climate change because it's such a potent greenhouse gas, and we need to talk about really transitioning into a sustainable energy future. And I think we're going to have to talk about being more efficient, not having a natural gas vehicle that uses, you know, that the bigger it is, the bigger tax break it gets.
There, I have actually had conversations with people who think that natural gas does not give off CO2. And I think a PR campaign has been successful. But, I mean, it's a fossil fuel that, besides being methane, which is, as you say, a potent greenhouse gas, but when you burn it, it creates CO2 just like any other fossil fuel.
Absolutely. The gas industry has just, you know, they've been really slick. Their ad campaigns, the way they've been able to align with different environmental groups. They just know how to do a PR campaign, and it's frightening the amount of money that's being spent on PR right now. You know, we in D.C., you see an enormous number of ads by the gas industry talking about how safe it is. And we know that T. Boone Pickens alone has vowed to spend this year $84 million promoting natural gas. And so, you know, that using that amount of money, really, it's really paid off for them.
At the expense of so many people. And, I mean, one comes to love the people in this film because they are just the most ordinary Americans, and they are truly suffering, and they're truly trying to get the word out. But they have no representation. I mean, as one of the people in the film put it, the only way that we can be represented, since the gas companies don't care about us at all, and the environmental protection agencies of the different states also don't care about us, we can only hire attorneys. Well, what ordinary person can afford an attorney who can go up against the attorneys of a gas company?
That's exactly right. And, you know, this rush to fracking has been facilitated by just millions of dollars, not only in advertising, but in lobbying Congress to sell, you know, so-called clean natural gas. In our report, we did an analysis of campaign contributions. And between 2005 and 2010, the 10 largest natural gas producers and their two trade associations spent $370 million lobbying for their interests. And that's, you know, they're basically buying public policy. That's how they've gotten this Nat Gas Act to be introduced and gotten so many sponsors.
We're talking to Winona Howder, the executive director of Food and Water Watch. The oil and gas sector is huge, but the installations, the individual gas installations, extracting fields, are fairly small. Explain this to us. Apparently, this means that the Clean Air Act doesn't apply.
Yeah, that's right. The Clean Air Act is largely about air pollution in big urban areas where there's a point source of pollution. And so they have managed to figure out how to exempt this industry from a lot of our air and our water regulations. And, you know, the other thing I think we need to really remember about this is that they're going into these rural areas that are suffering from the economic recession. And in a lot of areas, these are agricultural areas that, you know, here in the West, it might have been ranching. In the East, it's New York State where this is being fought. It's the dairies have been put out of business, and farming, people can't make a living farming any longer. And so what's happening is that these rural areas are becoming sacrifice zones, and sacrifice zones not just to the pollution this creates, but even to, you know, EPA has estimated that building and fracking one well creates 1,000 heavy truck trips. So you're talking about really ruining the quality of life in these areas in so many ways. So we think that we don't have to just, we need to go beyond fighting fracking, and we need to help restore the ability of rural people to make a living from agriculture. Because, I mean, really, what do we want to produce in rural areas? Is it, you know, industrial production for ethanol or for natural gas? I mean, shouldn't we be producing food? And so, that would be getting into other issues in the subject of today's radio show. But we believe that we do need to link these issues, and we need to reform agriculture policy so that many of these depressed areas have some other option than buying, or rather than selling, the right to drill or to use their water for fracking.
There's also the issue that when the natural gas is extracted, it's it's very hard to go back to the way it was before because the land is polluted and it can't be used anymore. It can't just be restored overnight or even in a period of a few generations.
That's exactly right. I mean, you literally are making a sacrifice zone of this area where the water is polluted, the land is polluted, the air is polluted, and you're left with a lot of people who can't sell their home. They can't sell their farm, so they're forced to live there in this horrible pollution with their children sick and just horrible health problems.
Now, you are with Food and Water Watch. We're talking to Winona Howder, the executive director of that organization, foodandwaterwatch.org, on the web. What are you working on? What are you doing to fight hydraulic fracturing or fracking, and what does the movement look like around the country?
You know, there's a really growing movement. I mean, one of the most exciting things that we saw this year was the largest student gathering in history happened in D.C. With 10,000 students from around the country coming to talk about the issues related to climate change. 900 of those students vowed to go back to their college campus and make this a primary issue. What Food and Water Watch is doing is we have a national campaign to ban fracking, and we're working in different states where there's state legislation to help deal with this issue. I mean, we see our role, along with some other groups that want to talk more broadly about getting rid of this industry, we see our role as opening the political space in different locations to talk about what this industry is doing and to begin passing legislation to deal with it. And we're urging the people who are residents of these states, and it's almost 40 states in the union, to, in their own community, pass a resolution to ban fracking. This is both a way to educate people about what's going on and a way to protect the community. Now, I know there was a resolution passed in Santa Fe County. I think it's a good resolution, but it is a resolution that regulates the industry. And I think it's good to talk about banning this fracking. And it's good to let people know that it's okay to talk about getting rid of an industry, even when they say that it's creating jobs and helping the environment. And we have to be able to educate people and create a constituency of people who know that this just isn't the case. And let me say one thing that we're trying to bring to light in our campaign, and that's around this argument of job creation. What we're finding in the states where fracking is taking place, especially outside of Texas, where there is already a strong oil and gas industry, mostly they're bringing in rednecks from out of state. They're bringing in a workforce, a transient workforce. It's not the population that lives there. They're bringing in people who know how to operate this equipment, and it's not a job creator. It's a job killer. In the areas of the country that already have tourism and that people come and visit, you know, there's the potential that the beautiful scenic area that people come to visit is going to be wrecked. It also, in the places that are already fracking, it's affecting the value of land and of home sales. And we've seen in states like New York, where there's a really active campaign to ban fracking, that real estate and industry is joining with us in certain parts of the state because they see that this is not going to, in the long term, create the kind of economic development that allows people to buy and sell homes.
Exactly.
So we would urge people to go to our website. If you want to get involved, contact us. There are a lot of people doing work on this already in New Mexico, and I think that we can really stop this industry in its tracks and stop letting them lie to people about what this really means.
With great respect, stopping an industry in its tracks that owns the political process and has about a gazillion times more money than all of us put together seems a little bit tricky. I keep wondering whether there isn't a way to somehow incentivize that industry so that it starts investing in solar and wind or something like that. I mean, what are they going to do, go home?
Well, remember, T. Boone Pickens was going to be the biggest investor in wind energy in the country, and he traveled around the U.S. a few years ago talking about wind development and how great it was. He canceled $1.5 billion of wind turbine orders and started talking about natural gas instead. We've seen the oil industry talk about getting into solar development, and when they've bought solar companies that were beginning to be profitable, basically they've liquidated them. You know, I think what we need to do is start fighting for what we really want and not believing that the market's going to solve our problems. You know, I think the so-called market solutions have, they haven't brought us what we need. And, you know, I know that there are many good environmental groups that are working for regulation of this industry. You know, and I think that our ban message helps strengthen them. You know, number one, it creates the political space to talk about all the problems. Number two, we make them look a lot more reasonable. So, you know, I think you need to have people out there talking about what there should be to even get what's politically possible. And if we don't start fighting for what we want, nothing is going to be politically possible. And that's why we've lost so much ground over the last 20 or 30 years.
We're talking to Winona Howder of Food and Water Watch. Tell us more about the organization and some of the other things that you're working on.
Oh, I'd love to. Well, Food and Water Watch is a national organization with 12 offices around the U.S. We also have a staff in Europe and a small staff in Latin America. And we're focused on the corporate control of our precious resources. One of our big initiatives for the next few years is around food policy. We're working very hard for the next farm bill to make sure that our food and farm policies in the U.S. allow farmers to make a living and people to get good, healthy food. And we'd urge you to look at some of these issues. We've worked a lot on water issues because water is a dwindling resource. There's a big move for companies to come in and privatize municipal resources to get a hold of water resources, and we do that. We work a lot on the technologies also that we think aren't going to lead us to a safe food or, for that matter, safe drinking and recreational water. So things like genetic engineering and also nanotechnology and some of these other technologies, food irradiation. And we have a commitment to going out with communities and organizing, working with the, you know, existing community organizations and state organizations and bringing our research skills into an area to help strengthen the organizing that's going on. So you can find us again at foodandwaterwatch.org.
How do you envision, and what tools do you use to envision our nation's and perhaps our world's energy future?
Well, you know, what we believe is missing is that to really turn things around, we need to have community organizing going on in every legislative district in the country. And we believe that food and water issues resonate with people and that those issues then educate people, and people then get involved where there's really good organizing going on, and they get involved and they vote for their self-interest and for their health and their family's health and safety. And, you know, we need to get back to the kind of political campaigning that relies on people, not money. Now, I know in this day and age where public policy is bought, it's sometimes hard to envision that, but we believe that we have to keep fighting for that. So we use a kind of organizing that relies on research and then using that research to go out and get media, and then using our ability to connect with different groups and different people, start building around our goals. So, you know, one of the things that we did was we organized a campaign around, it was a corporate campaign, on Starbucks. It took us 2 years, but we campaigned around the country and we got them to change their practice of using milk with artificial hormones. So, you know, we believe you have to be very practical and have a practical goal, but you have to go out and organize people and get them involved in what you're trying to achieve. You can only do so much by lobbying, because if we were going to win on the facts, we'd have already won.
Right. That's so true. How do you work with the corporate media, as Amy Goodman calls it, but in other words, most of the media except public and independent radio stations such as the one that we're talking on right now, basically are beholden to their advertisers whose interests are really exactly the opposite of, at least in the short run, of the kinds of things that you're doing?
Well, you know, I think what you talk about is probably our biggest challenge, and I think it's our biggest collective challenge, is how do you get our messages out there in a society where people work two jobs, they come home, they turn on the television, they are marketed to, and they watch things that often don't deal with the important issues in life in a news media that doesn't tell us the truth. And I think that we do work with the corporate media with our research and reports. I mean, and we, although in my lifetime of organizing over the last 30-plus years, I've seen it's much more difficult to place articles than it used to be, although we are able to do it. I think we also we use the alternative media. I think social media is really, and the Internet is enabling us to meet a lot more people. We're using social media to reach out and involve people in public policy. You know, and let me give you an example. So when President Obama was campaigning in areas of the country that do livestock production, he promised to look at the consolidation and the failure of the federal government to obey antitrust laws. And there's a something that we won in the last farm bill that makes it tougher for the corporatized consolidated meat industry to makes it more expensive for them to do business because they have to be fairer in the way they deal with livestock producers. And, you know, it's a kind of technical thing, but it gets to the very inability of livestock producers to make a living. The President Obama did the first step that he promised, that he has not allowed, and we hear that it does come from the White House, has not allowed the Secretary of Agriculture to finalize these rules that keep the meat industry from dealing so unfairly with livestock producers. So we're using our social media tools to do call-in days to the White House, to do media events, and we've been doing this with coalition partners for about the last year. We have another call-in day on the 22nd, and we expect that we will tie up the lines at the White House and get thousands of people to call in. And it also is a way that, you know, people can do some local organizing, getting, you know, if they get two other people to call the White House, that's a terrific thing. Because the president needs to know that we're watching, and when he makes a promise, it could be on any issue, that really they need to follow through and not give in to industry. So, you know, it's an uphill battle, but I think that's what it's going to take
right.
if we're going to ever turn this country around. And, you know, I kind of look at it over the span of time. So, you know, we've achieved a lot since feudal times, and we're never going to reach a point that's perfect because we have a lot of greedy interests and people who only care about themselves. But in each generation, we have to try to keep those economic interests in line and achieve what we can, and then we have to help mentor and bring along the next generation to try to, create the kind of world we all want to live in.
Winona Howder is Executive Director of Food and Water Watch on the web at foodandwaterwatch.org. They're sponsoring a screening of the film Gasland tonight at 7 o'clock at the Center for Contemporary Arts here in Santa Fe. And it's also co-sponsored by Conservation Voters New Mexico and Drilling Mora County. Thanks so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thanks so much for having me.
I'd like now to welcome back to the program Lorelei Novak. She is with the Northern New Mexico Citizens Advisory Board, and they are having an event tomorrow evening, June 22nd, called Surface and Groundwater Quality at Los Alamos National Laboratory, an update for our community. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. Great to be here.
So this is an event that starts at 4:30. It goes for about 4 hours at Santa Fe Community College in the Jemez Rooms. What will you be doing? How has this work evolved since the last time I saw you?
Well, the board has continued to study groundwater and surface quality at LANL. We work through the Department of Energy. The board is chartered. It's a group of volunteer citizens that are federally chartered under the Federal Advisory Committee Act to provide advice and recommendation to the Department of Energy on cleanup issues at Los Alamos National Laboratory. So basically, what LANL and DOE does is they provide these educational opportunities so that they can get educated advice from the public.
And so what have they, if you can, I don't know if you can, how much of this you can summarize for us, but what have they actually found about water quality?
Well, you know, for the most part, there's good news, and there's been a lot of work done up there to address the contamination that's there. The outfalls have been reduced, pathways have been stopped. Basically, there's a few areas of concern left, and they really want to give an update to the community. There's some, it's really more for the experts to talk about, but there are a few areas of concern, and
Chromium in the water, things like that?
Well, it's chromium in an isolated area that's being kind of held in a wetland area, but they're addressing the extent and the nature of it. That's definitely an area of concern. And then there's some high explosives area in Canyon Divide.
Now, there's surface and groundwater, and those are, of course, separate things. Surfaces are rivers and streams and rainwater, stormwater, and groundwater involves, when you talk about the groundwater and the aquifers, it's a very complicated course of study because it's not like clean pipes or something
right.
like that underneath the ground.
And the stratigraphy at LANL is very complex. There's several different groundwater zones. There's alluvial, which is sort of on the top, and then there's perched intermediate, and the goes down to the bottom, which is the groundwater. It's a regional aquifer, and it basically goes underneath LANL. So there is a lot of concern to make sure that that is safe and free of contamination. And there's been just tremendous amount of study up at the lab. There's huge monitoring well networks around the areas that are their material disposal areas that have some buried low-level transuranic waste, and some of that waste is headed to WIP. Some is staying at this time in these material disposal areas. And so what the lab wants to do is to make sure that that contamination is not spreading any further than the contained area in which it's stored.
So there will be tomorrow night at 4:30 a kind of poster session, which means you can go and look at the walls and
yeah,
all the things that
yeah,
people
yeah.
have put up on these posters. And then there will be presentations starting at 5:30. There will be presentations about surface and groundwater, and then panelists will answer questions for the public. And the panelists
right.
are all kinds of people.
Yeah, there's going to be, we've invited folks from the Pueblos. We've got confirmation from the Concerned Citizens for Nuclear Safety that they're going to be sitting on our panel and have a poster. The presentations are overview presentations, and then we head to like a poster session intensive where people can go and get their questions answered. And then we finish it off with this moderated question and answer panel. There'll be folks from subject matter experts from LANL, DOE. We've invited city, county, state representatives. And, you know, we really hope to just educate the public, answer questions. One of the things I think the laboratory wants to get across to the public is, you know, what programs are in place to stop this contamination, any runoff? There's been all kinds of surface and groundwater programs to really reduce that. And it's quite complex, more complex than I can really address for you here today. And I'm not a subject matter expert, but there's a lot going on up there.
And so the public will have the opportunity to ask questions of all the different people there. Once again, it's the Surface and Groundwater Quality at LANL, an update for our community event on Tuesday, tomorrow, June 22nd, at the Santa Fe Community College Jemez Rooms. For more information, you can call 989-1662. And Lorelei Novak is with the Northern New Mexico Citizens Advisory Board. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org. Thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe, and my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, then local news, then jazz.